I'm Patricia Camilleri, Director of the Communications and Alumni Relations Office here at the University. In this series called Research Matters, I shall be discussing a wide range of research projects in which our academics are currently involved. With me in the studio today is Professor Raymond L. Lu from the Department of Physics here at the University. He's here today to talk to us about atmospheric pollution in the Mediterranean and its relationship to climate change, which is obviously an extremely topical issue. But before discovering the details about the research, which I'm looking forward to, I'd like to tell listeners a little bit about Professor Lu. He gained his bachelor's and master's degrees here at the University of Malta in the late 70s, and then did his doctorate in 1981 at the Max Planck Institute in Mülheim Ruhr in Germany. I hope I pronounced that right. He then worked for some 7 or 8 years, both in Germany and in the UK, before returning to Malta at the end of 1987, and he's been here since then. He started the atmospheric research work in 1993, when he spent And I imagine an interesting sabbatical year with Professor Crutzen, the Nobel Prize laureate at the Max Planck Institute in Mainz in Germany. He is today a Gozerton by adoption, he says. He hasn't actually taken on citizenship yet, but I suppose that's a useful thing, since I know that a lot of the practical side of your project happens in Gozo, so I suppose
that's right. Living
there has its uses. Welcome to you, Professor.
Thank you very much, Pat. I'm very glad to be here.
And so this is a huge project that has now been working for some years. How did it all start off? I mean, I know that you say it was kicked off by the sabbatical year with Professor Crutzen, but tell us more about that.
Yes. Well, first of all, my background is actually in gas kinetics, a branch of physical chemistry, so it's an interdisciplinary subject. And I was in touch with Professor Crutzen in the early 90s. He then invited me to go over for a year to get back into the subject in a rather deeper fashion than I had. I am a member of the Max Planck Society anyway, so this was very easy to arrange. And Crutzen was one of the foremost people in the subject. He had written the book explaining what would happen if the two superpowers exchanged nuclear missiles. It would have ended up as a nuclear winter with a total climate change. It was a very theoretical book, but it sparked off the subject in the 80s. So I was very glad to work with him and got a good grounding there. We had talked about establishing an atmospheric monitoring program somewhere on the Maltese Islands because of its strategic position, basically. We are midway between Southern Europe and North Africa, which is ideal. We wanted somewhere nice and clean to measure background air. Obviously, it had to be away from urban centers, and we finally found somewhere on Gozo our now well-known Jordan Lighthouse. Professor Crutzen donated the first instruments, which we put in there. We started to measure ozone. Later on, we formed close associations with many other institutes, primarily in Germany, because, of course, that was my background. And apart from that, the Germans are very well known for atmospheric research. They always dominate any conferences in the subject. They have such a massive effort in the area. We obtained more instruments from the International Bureau in the Jülich Research Centers, and my friend Dr. Hans Gusten from the Karlsruhe Research Center. And we set up and started measuring gases such as ozone, carbon monoxide, sulfur dioxide, meteorological barometers, wind speed direction, temperature, relative humidity, radiation, and so on. This was also done in conjunction with the Meteorological Office over here, because we essentially report, as it were, back to WMO in Geneva. This is a United Nations agency responsible for running what we call the Global Atmospheric Watch Program, which is just now 25 years old this month, as a matter of fact. There is a little celebration in Geneva in May, where I will be giving a talk on our on the summary of our work over the last 12, 13 years.
A project like this must need to have these partners, because you need to be comparing, you need to be contrasting, you need to be
listening
to what other people are doing.
This is not a local project. Obviously, it has to be run locally with local staff and PhD students and master's students and so on helping out. But it is very much an international United Nations program. Each country supplies its own station, so to speak, but all the results from all stations in the world are combined. There are 22 major stations throughout the world, in far-flung places such as Cape Town, Tasmania, Alaska, Antarctica, etc., all of them measuring all these very interesting trace gases and other meteorological parameters. The data are assembled by the Japanese Meteorological Agency in Tokyo, and published every year, including ours. There are many, many stations worldwide, both primary and secondary, but essentially it all comes together and it is a relatively small community. We meet once or twice a year to discuss results, typically about 80, maybe at most 100 people, getting together, explaining what they have found. And of course, this is a very long-term kind of work, because we need to look at what is happening both to the trace gases and the meteorological parameters over a span of 20, 30, 50, 100 years. And the mathematical modelers at the various worldwide institutes are modeling the results to try and project what will happen by 2050, 2100, the year 3000. This is absolutely essential because climate change takes place over a relatively long time span, though it's not that long enough, unfortunately.
You've got these aims, which are, I suppose, at various levels. You've got sort of the day-to-day aims of measurement, etc. And then you've got sort of middle-term aims, and then you've got these extremely long-term aims as well, sort of longitudinal study in the extreme.
That's right. On a day-to-day basis, we have to run the instruments, we have to calibrate them very carefully, otherwise the data are meaningless. We have to archive the data, we have to remove what we call local anthropogenic events, because those are not of any importance. If, you know, you have an emission from the local power station that happens to be measured by us on the day, we identify it and, as it were, remove it from the data, because that is a local thing. Incidentally, this data, when I say remove it, we don't just erase it, we store it separately, because it is naturally of interest to local entities, such as our Malta Resources Authority, our MEPA, who monitor local pollution, civil protection, and many other entities who all come to us for data and results.
And I suppose some of these events are local, but some of them could be international events, but that affect us just the same.
They are locally generated events, but they are of international importance, whether they come from Malta or Sicily or Germany or France, because air transmission or air movements are international. They don't respect any borders. So essentially, we're looking at each other's polluted events. In the Mediterranean, we have realized over the past 12, 13 years, we have been making the measurements, that there are many events originating in Northern Europe and Southern Europe, and also relatively locally in Sicily. And we measure all of these, and we can work back to where they originated from quite easily. Apart from that, though, there are also large amounts of pollution that come over to the stratosphere, which is the upper atmosphere, from the United States and from Southeast Asia. There was a big campaign in 2001, the so-called MINOS campaign by the Max Planck Institute for Chemistry in Mainz, by Crutzen and Lelefeld, whom we work with, and they published a very important paper showing all this. There were ground measurements, there were aircraft measurements, etc., that were made in the Eastern Mediterranean based on Crete by our Greek colleagues. And the Mediterranean is essentially a kind of sink pot, unfortunately, for all this kind of pollution due to what we call the Hadley cells, the recirculation of the atmosphere up to about 30 kilometers. We are here at about 36 degrees latitude, and this is right in the middle of, in the middle between two such cells, where we get all the stuff recirculated into us. So the Mediterranean has a very high pollution background. Mm-hmm. For example, we measure ozone at about 50 parts per billion. This is practically the highest in the world. It affects the growing of crops locally. When I say crops, I mean mundane things like potatoes, tomatoes, lettuce, grapes, etc., all Mediterranean crops. The yield here is about 50% of what it could be had we not had this high ozone background. So it translates into a real practical economic loss. So the work we do has practical implications.
So if I've understood correctly, there are things going on in places like America, obviously.
Yes, that's right.
And they affect us because of a particular circulation natural phenomenon.
In the atmosphere, yes, a natural phenomenon. But it means that all that pollution gets transported to us here in the Mediterranean, unfortunately. There is little we can do about it, but we can use the results to pass on to our politicians, who can hopefully influence international policy decisions as to emissions of these pollutants. The CFCs was the old story regarding the ozone hole in Antarctica, and most countries have now seized those, except perhaps for China and India, who are also on the way there, but it, obviously it's taking a little time. And the other pollutants, the volatile organic compounds, the ozone generated, the carbon monoxide, the benzene, toluene, xylene, all these things are pollutants which come from industrialized countries, very often from their vehicles, and need to be looked at. Basically, the whole world needs to cut down on these pollutants. We need to move towards hydrogen as a fuel rather than oil. We need to cut out oil completely. And our results have a very practical bearing on what we should be doing in the future. And when I say the future, not too long in the future, over the next 20, 30, 50, maybe 100 years at most. In fact, many scientists, insofar as climate change, are already of the opinion that we are too late. The world is going to warm up by about 2 to 3 degrees within 50 years' time. It was thought that it would happen in 100 years' time. From the scientific community, we know that this is going almost certainly to happen by 2050, in 40 years' time. It's going to be a very different climate. It's going to be very hot here in the Mediterranean. This will obviously affect many industries, including the tourist industry, the manufacturing industry. We'll have problems with water generation. We need to insulate our homes properly. It all comes together. It is one big subject, which is all interlinked.
Professor, I think most people have understood now that climate change is happening, that it is a real phenomenon. Obviously, there over the millennia, there has been climate change on a sort of some sort of a cyclical basis as well. Are we going to be suffering from a combination of these events? Because you are measuring the particular and the general climate approach.
Yes, we are measuring, obviously, natural cycles. Those are always there, and we can do little about them. The world goes round the sun. It is tilted at 23 degrees to this axis, and there are seasonal changes. There are also changes over 100,000 years, what we call the Milankovitch cycles, which we cannot do anything about. But by far, the largest changes are coming from the greenhouse gas emissions and other pollutant emissions that mankind is essentially spewing out. The carbon dioxide level has not been this high for the last 650,000 years. And in fact, we have gone way beyond that now. And if we look back at the fossil records and the ice cores, we realize that the climate then was initially a hell of a lot hotter, and then came another ice age and several ice ages behind that. The last ice age ended about 10,000 years ago. The ice was down to the Alps, the whole of northern Europe was covered in ice, and northern America, and this could possibly happen again. And with present modern-day infrastructure, this is a paradox, because mankind was around for 10,000 years ago, but they were very primitive, and they could survive. Nowadays, with our airports, autobahns, roads, etc., we're going to have problems. So we may have to go in for what we call geoengineering, somehow deflecting the sun's rays to a certain extent before they reach Earth, to perhaps cut down on these 2 or 3 degrees, which is a fact, is going to happen, is going to happen by 2050, and there's nothing we can do about it.
Sounds like science fiction, but
it's not science fiction, it's very serious. Yeah, most scientists are convinced that if we don't take serious, very serious action within the next 10 years at the very most, we are going to be in big trouble. The world population now is in the region of, I think, 6 billion inhabitants. It is projected to go to about 9 billion inhabitants, if I remember correctly, in the next 20 years or so. By the time these major climate changes kick in, we could very well be down to survival of perhaps 1 billion of all those inhabitants, with luck. So the human species will continue to exist, but it might be a little hard on some of the individuals.
Well, I've been to the lighthouse, the Jordan Lighthouse, mm-hmm. and I must say I consider it one of the nicest places that I've been to in the Mediterranean. I think it's a superb spot. And as you say, you've chosen that because of its particular position. And what exactly happens at Jordan?
Basically, we make all the actual measurements. All our instruments are in there, plus all the meteorological parameters which are measured, which are incidentally also passed on to the Met Office automatically. At the moment, we're down for some months because the rooms we're using in the lighthouse are being refurbished. We have obtained €500,000 in ERDF funds to purchase new equipment, which hopefully will be in by the end of 2009. And then we'll be able to measure more accurately and a larger spectrum of trace gases and parameters. And this will essentially establish Jordan Lighthouse, the University of Malta, and the Maltese as contributing preeminently to one of these what we call global atmospheric watch stations, the data for which are available to any scientists worldwide. We'll be contributing to measuring and suggesting mitigating measures for climate change over the next 20 years or so, which we estimate is the lifetime of the instruments.
In fact, that was going to be my next question. You've got all this fantastic data, mm-hmm. And you have people working on it. You have doctoral students working on
That's
it.
Right.
You do your own work on it. So you've got the everyday content, and then you have the analysis of that that content. And you come up with these results.
Yeah.
I imagine that you go off to your partners and discuss, and you probably have conferences and talk
correct.
About it. It probably finds its way into eminent peer-reviewed journals. Beyond that, do you feel that you have an opportunity, perhaps not you personally, but do you feel that there is enough opportunity to try and influence policy makers, perhaps both locally and in a broader sense?
Yes, as you say, Pat, the results, which are very often part of masters and doctoral theses by various students working with us, incidentally, we're going to have on Gozo at the University Gozo Center, a research team of about 5 people by the end of this year or beginning of next year, working on the new instruments, because these require an awful lot of work, calibration, maintenance, working up of data, interpretation, etc. The results first always go into the peer-reviewed journals. That is a must. They have to be accepted professionally before they can be discussed in details. We go to conferences. We meet every year. We hold local events as well. These are used, as I say, by many entities who request them from time to time. There needs to be more interaction with our politicians, yes, They need to get the message across that we're actually doing something specific. And of course, when we have this very professional setup by the end of this year, this will then be a great leap forward. It is thanks to the structural funds which have been made available to Malta that this can be done, because this equipment is all very expensive. One aerosol spectrometer on its own is about 100,000 euros. So it's very specialized stuff. The results are published every year by the World Meteorological Organization. It comes out every March. Summary of the data of the previous year. This is available to everybody. It's a bit technical, but not that technical. And as I say, we do hold local events. We're hoping to be able to give a summary of the last 12 years of our results sometime in the next couple of months. It will be in the form of a public lecture of some kind.
These researchers, will they come from abroad? Do you have students of your own who are going to be able to participate?
It's a mixture of local students and foreign students. I think we had one of the first doctoral students here, Michael Nolle, who is now with MEPA, a German who started this work. At the moment, I've got Martin Saliba. He did his master's with us, and he stayed on as a long-term employee of the university to help with the instruments. We have other master's thesis coming up. There are several final year projects, all of which have been written up and which are available to anybody, essentially.
And what about future plans? I mean, are you going to be carrying on with the same work? You've mentioned these researchers, they're going to be working on new instruments. How is the project going to move forward?
We're expanding, essentially. Initially, we measured ozone and then carbon monoxide and sulfur dioxide. Ozone is some of the highest concentrations in the world. Carbon monoxide is fairly normal, but this enables us to trace back to the origin of these anthropogenic events, and sulfur dioxide is again a very high background in the Mediterranean due to, first of all, emissions from Malta itself, which need more cleaning up. There is also a high background possibly due to Etna, and also due to the shipping which passes between the Maltese islands and Sicily. We're talking of over 100,000 vessel movements per annum. Yeah. And ships burn a lot of very crude fuel. They are in international waters. They cannot be stopped. They need to be legislated on at the international level and made to use clean fuel. And they are contributing, we think, substantially to this background. Apart from that, we're putting in new instruments to measure both the aforementioned gases in a much more sensitive format. We're expanding to measure what we call nitrogen oxides, aerosols, radioactive compounds, radon-222, black carbon emitted from ships, etc. The sun's intensity, what we call the aerosol optical depth, etc. All of these parameters will go into the new models and will contribute substantially to our understanding of what is happening in the Mediterranean.
One of the lovely pictures that I love to look at on Google Maps is the Etna plume.
Yes.
And that actually, if the wind's in the right direction, it sort of comes exactly on top of Malta.
Yes, we've had that many times. Yes, it affects us directly. We're only 150 kilometers downwind. It doesn't always fall here directly, but when there is the right combination of meteorological conditions, yes, we get it in our back gardens. Back in, I think, early 2000, 2001, 2003, I remember going home and finding the yard and the roof covered in a thin black film of dust, and I wondered what it was. I first thought the power station, something's gone badly wrong. But the wind was from the north, not from the south. This was my place in Gozo. And then later, next day, we checked the instruments and we realized it was all coming from Etna, in fact. So we get quite a lot of fallout. Mm-hmm. And in the same way as we get it from Etna, we get it from the Saharan dust, which sometimes covers the islands for 2 or 3 days when visibility is very low. That is all dust, very fine dust, but dust. And it goes out as far as the Caribbean and as far east as eastern Turkey. and as far north as southern Germany and sometimes further. And it can be seen on satellite photographs and can be downloaded from any NASA or DLR website. And it's all to do with transmission of pollutants. We measure all this all the time.
I'm a great fan of electric vehicles, and I always feel in my heart of hearts, I don't have one myself, I must admit, but I feel that Malta is a perfect place for them. The pollution that we create with our cars, I don't know how many cars we have per person on the island.
I think it's almost up to 300,000 now, 250,000 definitely.
Almost as many cars as there are people. Would it actually have a beneficial effect on the island if we
locally it would help us an awful lot if we switch to electric vehicles. Electric vehicles need to be made to run on hydrogen, not simply on batteries. Batteries, however well developed, have their limits. They take a bit of time to charge. They are unwieldy. They have to be changed every 5 or 6 years, which is a major expense. You're probably talking about a couple of thousand euros to change them every 5-6 years. So we need to get away from that sort of thing towards the hydrogen-fueled vehicles, which technologically is perfectly doable. We have the technology, we have the know-how, there's no problem. It is just the oil lobby, which worldwide is still very, very strong. And the politicians, both in Europe and the United States and the Southeast Asia and China, and Russia need to move in a concerted way on this and say, look, within 5 years, within 10 years, we're going to change, and there's no ifs and buts about it. You have to do it. Oil can still be used. We need it for other things. We need it to make plastics. We need it to make things which are essential to our industrialized societies. It's not a question of the oil companies are going to be out of a job. That is a very silly thing to say.
And anyway, I suppose in a number of years, the oil reserves will eventually run out.
So. I don't know how long they will last, maybe 20, 50 or another 100 years. But we are probably at the peak now, and it will start going down. And the price of oil starts to go up. We need to move away from it. It's as simple as that. It needs to be a worldwide policy decision that is made and implemented. The Americans like to leave it to the marketplace. The Europeans tend to go for legislation. We need a mixture of both, but we need to move on this. We're not going to get rid of our cars. Forget it. We love our cars too much. I do. I couldn't get by without it. But we need to move to a different fuel, which would be a clean fuel, basically hydrogen.
Well, thank you very, very much, Professor.
You're welcome, Pat. It was a pleasure discussing this.
Today. Very interesting topic. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you would like further details about the University of Malta's research projects or any other information, please access our website at www.um.edu.mt. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.